This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's the Now News Panel on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown, joined by Michelle McQuigg and Joita Gupta. Let's discuss our next topic. A major strike could be on the horizon for 60,000 behind-the-scene workers in the TV and film industry. Members of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees plan to potentially walk off productions across North America next week. The workers have been without a contract since June of this year. They are demanding better working conditions. Specifically, they're looking for more paid breaks during grueling production days. There are concerns about low wages in some of the crafts, and the union is also suggesting that new media streaming services are paying even less compensation. Michelle, there's a lot to talk about here, but where do you think we should begin?
There is, and I mean, when I pitched this topic, I was thinking to myself, we've talked a fair bit about labor issues and strikes happen all the time, but few get people's attention like someone that's coming in to potentially mess with your TV content or your appointment viewing, especially after the pandemic when people have gotten, frankly, pretty attached to certain programs and use that to get through a lot of things, and some are, still are. So it is a bit tricky to know where to begin. We could start by talking about some of the bigger labor questions that this raises in terms of workers potentially being in a position of strength to negotiate at a time when industries are kind of on their knees after the pandemic hits that they've taken. We could talk about the specific demands that the workers are making, which seem really fundamental, especially as you just summed them up. We hear stories about people having less than 8 hours between shifts. Among other things, there's a whole Twitter account actually dedicated to some horror stories that come out. We could talk about the very proviso that you mentioned at the end, Dave, too, about streaming services paying less. This was done as a result of an economic adaptation that was made early on when they didn't quite have the revenue streams to compete with the big studios, but that hasn't yet been corrected and has not trickled down to the workers. So I'm actually happy to let you guys run with this. There is a lot to go with, for sure.
Joita, I know you and I have spoken a number of times on the air and off the air about labor rights and labor disputes and the importance of fighting for these rights. And just last segment, we were talking about silos. And if there's one thing I know from the TV production and movie production world, is there's always been that culture of, yep, 18-hour days, yep, 20-hour days, that's the business, that's how you do it. So when we're talking about this labor dispute, how fundamental is it that we actually look at these conditions and potentially question the overall culture of production?
I think it is something that is worth looking at, and it's not the only profession where people work extremely long hours, but I think there's not as much awareness, and really what IATSE, the union, is asking for is a 10-hour workday, which still seems pretty long. I mean, most of us are used to the idea of an 8-hour workday. Now, realistically, whether you're a gig worker or you're driving an Uber or if you're a nurse, you are working quite a bit more than the standard 8-hour workday. Nonetheless, I don't think a lot of people realize how much sweat and how many hours of work goes into a single TV production or a movie. The other piece around this that was interesting is that the pushback has been that if you want shorter work days, A, it's unavoidable, especially towards the start of a production or towards the end of a production. But B, if you want shorter work days, fine, we'll give you shorter work days. But then you need to take a corresponding pay cut. But most people are, the argument being, well, you should be happy to work an 18-hour workday because you're getting paid for an 18-hour workday. The downside with this is, of course, it's taken a massive toll. I don't think I need to belabor the issue on people's mental health and work-life balance. And if you'll allow me to push the envelope a little bit, let's just talk about how the kinds of profits that studios have historically managed to earn, and maybe, you know, we can quarrel about the fact that they might have taken a bit of a hit during the pandemic, but overall, studios and the top paying actors have done extremely well for themselves. So it's no wonder that the people who are the bottom of the rung or the bottom of the food chain are the ones who are working these really long hours. Often their work goes unacknowledged, and now they're asking for things that are really, if you step back and think about it, pretty reasonable.
Yeah, when you're talking about some of the profits, it is fascinating because we do see these these films like Avengers Endgame grossing in the billions of dollars, mm-hmm. right? Not in the hundreds of millions, in the billions of dollars. But it is also worth noting that Netflix in its existence has never turned a profit because they just throw so much money at creating content. So although their revenue is really high, they're also an engine creating a lot of jobs as well. And Michelle identified that streaming services in 2009, the last time a deal was ratified after the writers' strike, gave streaming services, which were in their infancy at that point, certain breaks, saying, well, listen, these corporations are fledgling. They're not quite getting started yet. We're going to allow them to pay you less to do this work, even in unionized gigs. And that's something to me, Michelle, that stands out to me, that yes, these places haven't made a profit, but the revenue is high enough. The amount of money being spent is high enough. The sort of corporate size is high enough. It's time to bring those companies in line with the Disneys and the Warners and the Paramounts mm-hmm. of the world.
Absolutely. And that's a huge demand. And you talked, Joita, about the lowest paid workers. And that really is, I think, the crux of the matter. The money is now there. The workers aren't seeing it. So they might be throwing that revenue around. They might not be turning profits. Wherever the funds are going, it's certainly not to the people at issue right now. And that's such a common feature of big labor. Generally, that it's always the lowest paid workers. We've seen it again and again during the pandemic, whether it's Amazon warehouse workers or people living on the margins of society, people in those conditions and in those circumstances have had to bear the brunt of most things. And this seems to be happening once again. I'm really kind of struck by the sea change in the tone of the conversation in that correct me if I'm wrong, but when I was growing up, I used to hear about labor negotiations and union talks and whatever. And basically, as soon as you heard the word raise, you could kind of assume that it was over, that people got what they wanted. It was now over. Money was the big question. It's now been resolved. Let's move on. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, that's not it. That's not the only thing. Obviously, it is a big factor. People always want more money. That's always going to be an issue. But the issue of work-life balance seems to be so much more prevalent and getting so much more airtime. And that really does seem to be the primary focus for this particular union.
Yeah.
And I find that to be a really interesting shift.
It's almost like going back in time, because so many of the early union battles were simply about working conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a competent like time machine.
Kits on site or breaks during work. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Joita, what do you make of that in the way in which perhaps labor negotiations now are a little bit different than they've been, at least in recent history, that there does seem to be some cultural components in regard to what unions are asking for in negotiations with management?
I think you nailed it back there when you said that it's really like jumping into a time machine. A lot of the things that workers and by extension their unions fought for were things like the 8-hour workday, the right to a weekend. These are all things that came about as a result of union activity. The problem is, to be honest with you, the numbers of Canadians and the number of people who are unionized has declined over the years. There's been a rise in gig work. And so the tone has definitely shifted because there are many more workers who are feeling extremely vulnerable. They're not secure in their work. They are struggling on low wages. They are people don't have benefits. They don't have pensions. They don't have all kinds of things that aren't even really getting talked about as part of these negotiations, as far as I can see. But there's a plethora of issues that impact workers across the board, whether or not they're unionized. That's why you're seeing so much support for IATSE right now. And it's not just support from, people like the Directors Guild, and you've got some pretty big names signing on in support of IATSE. But it's ordinary people who say, yes, this resonates with me because their struggle is my struggle.
So we're a little tight for time here, guys, but there's a couple more questions I do want to bring into this one, because Michelle, in an email this week, you raised the possibility or you raised the notion that film production and TV production is a huge economic engine in so many places across North America, around the world, to the point that oftentimes governments are giving large, large tax breaks to studios and industries to do filming in their neck of the woods. And that does lead us into a question in regards to that economic power, that economic engine. Joita, do you foresee the possibility that maybe a government might step in here and mandate some back-to-work legislation?
No, it's pretty unlikely. I mean, they might, but it's unlikely. Oftentimes, the workers who are most likely to be mandated back to work, or where, you know, strikes, where they try to avert strikes, is in case of essential services.
Public transit, healthcare, yes, education.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, with something like education, you know, if you remember the York University strike from 10 years ago, or even sooner than that, yes, they've been mandated back to work. But in this instance, the other thing to keep in mind is that no one really wants a strike. The studio doesn't want the strike because they've been hard hit by the pandemic. The workers don't want a strike because they'll be going on strike pay. The strike position is a negotiating tactic. Let's not forget that they're back at the negotiating table. So who's to say that they'll actually end up having a strike come Monday? If they do, we are quite a ways away from a scenario where the government may mandate them back to work. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's not something that I see. And if you want to know, if that means that I'm going to go without seeing the next season of The Witcher, or if I have to go without, you know, watching the next season of Emily in Paris, you know what? Small price to pay.
Michelle, you posed the question to us via email. I now bounce the question back to you. Do you see the possibility of a government stepping in here? I mean, it's difficult because this spans state and national lines.
They do. I don't foresee that happening at all, actually, for a lot of the same reasons Joita mentioned. Also, just the fact that it doesn't sound like they're that far apart. Obviously, there has been a breakdown in talks, or we wouldn't be here. But the issues at hand are not the kind of things where government would normally either, you know, send in a conciliator or take more drastic action. And governments don't like to do that anyway. So I strongly suspect this wouldn't come to pass in this particular case. But it does speak. The questions it raises that we don't have time for today, though, are what industries merit that kind of treatment? It's not just confined to the fields that we mentioned. That is the main one, of course, but there are questions about which industries count and which ones don't.
So as I've talked about on the show many, many times before, I am typically pro-labor, and I was thinking about it as I was reading up on this issue, thinking about, as myself, as a member of the TV and film industry, what I might do next week in solidarity if a strike were to happen. I'm certainly not going to walk off the show, but I was thinking to myself, what can be done? What might be asked of me to show solidarity with the union? And then I got to thinking, well, if they asked me to boycott content for a week or for the duration of the strike, could I do that? Could I boycott commercial content? So Netflix, Amazon Prime, Disney, take your pick, go into the movies, etc. Joita, do you think you would be able, in solidarity, be able to cut yourself off from commercial content in solidarity with these workers?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason is simple. I mean, partly it's to support the workers, but partly it's because I'm short on sleep.
That's a good one too. Although YouTube can still get in the way on that one, Joita. Michelle, what about you? Do you think if you were asked, if the union were to put that out and say a way of showing solidarity with us would be to cut yourself off from commercial content, would you be able to do that?
Absolutely, I could, but I'd be like less than half a drop in the ocean, never mind the bucket, in terms of support, because I'm such a lame TV consumer anyway. But yes, I absolutely do that.
Oh my gosh. I do want to mention one more thing before we go, though. Going back to those negotiations in 2009 around the writer's strike, there was an unforeseen consequence that came out of that, which is an explosion in reusing intellectual property after the writer's strike. So although the writers got the deal they were looking for, the industry did evolve and started making much worse content as a result. So I always worry about what might be some of the unintended consequences that come out of a labor movement like this. So that's just one question that I want you guys to sort of consider and take into the weekend and think about. So Joita,
It's worth noting, though, that they do have the weekend to negotiate. This is not supposed to start until Monday, so this could well be averted.
Yes.
That's all.
Michelle, I love your optimism. You were calling Joita an optimist earlier. I like your optimism at the end of this segment. Thanks for bringing the story to the table, Michelle. Coming up next, with tuition rates on the rise, a precarious job market, and a dissatisfied university faculty, we'll ask the question, are universities facing a crisis? This is the Now News Panel on AMI. You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.